This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. When researchers at Bell Labs demonstrated the first transistor in 1947, it was a pretty big deal. This small solid-state device could replace the functions of bulky hot vacuum tubes. When the integrated circuit came along in the late 1950s, it meant that transistors, the wires that connect them and other devices, could all be shrunken down and built at once, a complete circuit on a single silicon chip. Fast forward a few years, 1971. Intel releases their 4004 microprocessor, and it contains some 2,300 transistors. Sound pretty good? Well, today, one of Intel's Pentium 4 processors packs a whopping 55 million transistors on one chip. How many can we get on there? What is the theoretical limit? How far can this trend continue? Well, it can't continue much longer, researchers say, at least not with using silicon as the chip, as the base. There are limits to how small devices can be made on a silicon chip and still work. So how to move on beyond silicon? Many researchers are looking for something new. They're conducting basic research on technology using exotic materials such as tiny cylindrical lattice tubes made of carbon. Others are working on using simple chemistry that would allow components to virtually create themselves in big vats of chemicals. And work is progressing in the field of optical computing, where researchers report they've developed a hybrid plastic that can produce light when zapped with electricity. Hook that up to a fiber optics cable, and who knows where that might lead to. This hour we'll be talking about where all this may be heading. New computing technology on the microscopic, the nanoscale. Give us a call on number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, if you want more information, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my first guest. Thomas Tice is Director of Physical Science Research at IBM's T.J. Watson Research Center in Yorktown Heights. He joins us on the line. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Tell us, who owns the rights, so to speak, the bragging rights to the smallest transistor now?
Well, the smallest silicon transistor, I'm proud to say, IBM does own the bragging rights to that. Our researchers published a silicon transistor with a channel length of 6 nanometers. This was presented last December at a meeting of the major electrical engineering society. And 6 nanometers, for your listeners who aren't so familiar with this dimension, would be the size of just 2 or 3 small molecules laid end to end. So the silicon transistors are getting about as small as we think we can make them. In fact, we think a practical transistor that could be used to make, you know, put hundreds of millions or billions on a chip might be a little bit bigger than that experimental transistor that was just demonstrated.
And what's wrong with having that size transistor? It sounds like a pretty a lot of transistors on one chip, I mean.
Well, that's a really good question. And the biggest problem... what's wrong with that? Well, we haven't yet found the limit for what imaginative people can think of to do with information technology if they can put more of it on a chip and therefore make it cheaper. So we'd like to continue until people run out of ideas for what to do with all this stuff.
All right, that's your business hat. Now let's talk about your research hat.
Well, smaller is faster, it translates into cheaper, which means more application, so I can't get away from that business hat.
Right.
The problem, though, with the research end is that as you make these things smaller, they still dissipate power, and as you make them very small, you run into new effects, quantum mechanical effects, and so the power that's being expended or dissipated by the device becomes limited by things like quantum, by quantum tunneling. This is a leakage current which, if you make the device smaller, just gets larger, gets exponentially larger as you make it smaller. And we think this is going to be the ultimate limit for silicon devices, and it's also going to be an ultimate limit for any practical alternative. Say molecular device that we can think of right now.
Mm-hmm. So if I could summarize that in more of terms that I can understand, does that mean that as you get smaller, you're only shoving just a few electrons around, And you don't really know where they are then after a while because of, you know, the...
That's a pretty good way to put it.
You know, you don't know where they are because of the, you know, the uncertainty principle.
You have it exactly right. That's exactly right. If you confine the electrons to too small an area, the uncertainty principle says there's a chance they'll be outside that area where you're trying to confine them. And if they get outside, that means they leaked away and they expended some power when they did that. And that means your computer's sitting there not doing anything and still putting out a lot of heat. So we think it's really an economic limit in terms of how small we think we can make these things. Since we don't see any physical limit to making them, you know, essentially atom by atom.
So where is the research at IBM going now? And I've seen some interesting work being published recently.
Well, of course, we continue to try and extend the established technologies, but we're also, of course, looking at alternative ways to process and store and communicate information. And so you already mentioned one of our big alternative device exploratory efforts, which is the carbon nanotube transistors. Carbon nanotubes are the most amazing fibers. They're products of synthetic chemistry, so you can make them by the trillions in a chemical reactor. We have to be able to refine them and make them very pure for electronic applications, and many people around the world are working on that right now. But if we can do that, we think there might be a way to make not only very small devices, but also to make these devices very cheaply, because we will be able to fabricate them and assemble them by chemical methods rather than the kind of lithographic processes that we use now.
Tell me a bit, if you could describe it for us a bit, what is a nanotube transistor? How does it work? What does it look like?
Well, in many ways it works and looks like a conventional transistor, except instead of having, in a conventional transistor you have two metal contacts, and between them you have a channel of silicon, that's the semiconductor, and the semiconductor has the property that if you put an electric field across it, you can turn on or off the charge carriers. You can push them in or out of that channel, and when they're there, then the thing is carrying current, so it's an on switch, and when you apply a voltage that pushes the carriers away or out of the channel, that turns the device off. So that's the off position of the electrical switch. So that's how a silicon transistor works, and any transistor, that is any device that has three electrical contacts and therefore has amplification and therefore can be used as a switch to make very complex information processing systems. With the hundreds of millions of transistors that you mentioned in your introduction, that kind of a system can be built out of carbon nanotube transistors, because carbon nanotube transistors have those same properties. The thing that's unique, there are many things that are unique that are unlike semiconductor transistors. There are many things that are unique about the carbon nanotube transistors, but the thing that is most unique, I would say, is the fact that we have a good chance of building up the whole transistor, or perhaps a good fraction of it, by chemical synthetic techniques, or self-assembly, as people call it.
Now, I talked about that a little bit in the intro, self-assembly. Does that mean it's like doing a chemistry lab experiment where you dip stuff in?
That's what it means.
The transistor builds itself?
Well,
wow.
It doesn't build itself in the sense that nothing's going to happen without us guiding that process. But if you think about it, self-assembly occurs around us all the time in nature. It's a very natural thing. There's nothing unusual about it. Think about a snowflake. Snowflake starts to grow when you have a dust particle floating in a water vapor cloud. And if you have the right conditions of temperature and humidity, water molecules start to stick to the little dust particle, and you start to grow a crystal of ice, and then that crystal is being tumbled in the cloud, and so the temperature and the humidity are changing all the time, and it's those two variables, we would call them in manufacturing, we'd call them control variables or parameters, those determine the shape that the snowflake takes. Every snowflake's different because every snowflake follows a different trajectory in temperature and humidity as it tumbles in the cloud. What we want to do is use the same kind of natural tendency of, molecules and atoms to form complex structures, but we want to introduce the right conditions and the right components so that we can form technologically useful structures. That's what self-assembly is about.
Mm-hmm.
We call it guided self-assembly or directed self-assembly to express that idea that humans have to be involved to make anything useful come out of the process.
Did anybody ever tell you you sound like Mario Cuomo? I mean, I think I'm sounds like I'm talking to him. I'm sorry.
No, that's one comparison that I haven't heard before.
Your voice sounds exactly
like how my wife responds to that.
Well, you're in New York, so it's sort of safe. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. I also noticed that some other interesting stuff coming out of IBM and other researchers with nanotubes is the fact that you can put a charge on each end of the nanotube transistor and you can get it to light up.
Well, I told you that nanotubes in some ways were like conventional transistors, nanotube transistors, but in some ways they're very different. And one of the things that we found a couple of years ago was that they could be made, and here's a word for you, ambipolar. That means that you can make them conduct either electrons or, as we call it, holes, or the absence of electrons. So either they conduct a net negative charge or they conduct a net positive charge. And you can do this in the same tube at the same time. And so by arranging the contact potentials, the electric fields that you apply to the device the right way, you can inject electrons and holes into the same transistor, into the same single molecule, a single carbon nanotube, at the same time. Now, when the plus and minuses charges get together, they recombine, as we say, and they give off energy, and that energy comes off in the form of light. So the thing that was unique about this was that it was the first time that anyone's electrically connected up a molecular scale structure and turned on the electricity and had light come out of it. So we made the world's smallest light bulb, but I got to tell you, that's not why we made it. We were surprised. There was enough light coming out that we think these might actually have some useful applications as light emitters, and also as they also detect light quite well. They're good light detectors if you run them backwards. The reason we did the work, though, was we wanted to confirm the models that we have of how these carbon nanotubes function as transistors, how the current is transported through them, and how it's switched on and off when you apply the electric potentials. And those models are still controversial in the scientific and technical community, and so this was additional proof that our model was the correct model. That was the primary motivation for the work. But it was a lot of fun to see light coming out of a molecule that you could turn on.
Could you actually see the light? Actually see the light?
Well, actually, it's in the infrared. It happens that they chose they can determine the wavelength by determining the diameter of the tube, and our team picked a tube with a diameter that made it emit light at the same infrared frequency that's used in optical communication, say the communications on the Internet, for instance.
Tom, I'm going to have to tell you to hold on because we have to take a break.
Okay? Very good.
We'll come back and talk lots more about this nanotube to give off light and other nanosections. So stay with us. We'll be right back. We're talking with Thomas Theis, Director of Physical Science Research at the IBM T.J. Watson Research Center in Yorktown Heights. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Stanley Williams, who is Director of Quantum Research for Hewlett-Packard Labs in Palo Alto. And he'll be joining us from Stanford University to talk more about quantum effects, tiny nanotransistors. We'll talk about a little bit about a plastic transistor. We're going to talk about more about light-emitting transistors, all kinds of interesting material science. We don't get to talk a lot about material science. It's exciting. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the future of microelectronics, material science, physics, needed to make that future happen, all kinds of microcomputing going on here, and a nanometer scale. The old way to know. My guests are Stan Williams, Director of Quantum Science Research for HP Labs. He's joining us now from Palo Alto. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Stan. Also with us is Thomas Theis. He's Director of Physical Science at IBM's T.J. Watson Research Center. And now also joining us is John Wager. He's Professor in the School of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Thank you for joining us, John.
Hi, Ira.
Let me go to you, Stan, because Tom was talking a little bit before a little bit about these creating these transistors that can actually assemble themselves. Can you talk a little bit? That's your sort of your field.
Well, we have a complementary approach that we're pursuing. We actually don't think that transistors at the nanoscale are that interesting in terms of something that you'd actually want to manufacture and use, primarily because of something that occurs at the nanoscale effect called quantum mechanical tunneling.
Mm-hmm.
Transistor that you'd normally make at that size would have a problem in that it would leak current
right. Because
of quantum mechanical tunneling. And if you have a huge number of such transistors all leaking, what that amounts to is wasting power. So you could, in principle, be putting 1,000 amps of power into a system, and it would all just be sort of leaking away and not be very useful. So we've actually been pursuing a somewhat different approach, using similar types of ideas for self-assembly and being able to bring together molecules that act as electrical components in a circuit. But we've been pursuing an idea that we call the molecular switch, which is a molecule that undergoes either a shape change or some other type of mechanical motion, which allows the a junction between two metal wires or a semiconductor wire and a metal wire to become either a very low resistance or a very high resistance. In other words, just act as the type of wall switch that you'd have in a wall.
Mm-hmm.
The type of advantage to this system is that it's non-volatile. Once you've switched it, you can turn the electrical power off, and it stays in the same state for quite some time. So there's potential advantages to this.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, modern day electronics are based on transistors, and so as we go to smaller and smaller scales, we want to look at the new physics that the nanoscale allows us to access and see if there's other paradigms that we could use for manufacturing electronics. And so this is one of those paradigms that we're pursuing.
Of course, the transistor is important here because you can switch it on or off, as we were talking before with Tom Tice. And let's say in an on state, you have a 1, and an off state, you have a 0. So you have the bits that computers speak in, ones and zeros. And you're just saying you might be able to do the same thing with a switch, on and off, and not have to do a fancy transistor?
That's correct. There's some specific advantages to just using a network of switches in that you don't have to maintain power to keep the bit in place. That's the problem with a transistor, and that's the problem with a computer today. When you turn off a computer today and then you turn it back on, you have to wait a long time for it to boot back up again. And the reason for that is that the computer has forgotten the previous state that it was in. All of the switches just go away.
Right.
So we're looking at a different type of paradigm which uses molecular motions, molecular configuration changes to lock in a particular configuration and keep it so that it's there even when you turn the power off and then come back mm-hmm. and turn it on. It would effectively just come right back on in the state where you left it.
Hmm. John Wager, you wrote a commentary in the journal Science this week because there was a really interesting article, a report about the development of a transparent transistor. We can see right through the transistor?
Exactly. It's kind of an interesting idea.
Wow, it sounds like a great little device you want to pick up at Radio Shack, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think there are going to be a lot of applications for it. And this is a really new area. We published our first paper in February of this year, and there's been three other papers that have been published. This is the fourth other paper that I'm aware of that's been published. Most of the material up until this paper has been based on zinc oxide. So it's a beautiful day in Oregon today. My graduate students, they're supposed to be up in the lab making transparent transistors. I have a feeling that what they've done is they've put that white stuff on their nose as a sunblock and gone outside. And it turns out it's the same material used in the sunblock as we make the transparent transistors with.
So why do we want a transparent, besides looking nice and being cool, why do we want a transparent transistor?
Good question. A lot of people ask that. And first application that we see in your laptop computer, There are about hundreds of thousands of hundreds of millions of transistors already in there switching right now. Those are amorphous silicon transistors, and the problem with those is that they're light sensitive, and so they have to work to keep the light away from those transistors or they won't work. If we could replace all of those hundreds of thousands to hundreds of millions of transistors with transparent transistors, we could do a couple things. We could have more light come through the device, we could reduce the power, and also, potentially, if we can improve the electron transport, mobility is the actual term that we use, we could actually have better displays, and again, mainly power reduction that would be.
So you could make a, I don't know if people realize that the computer display, the flat panels they're looking at have millions of transistors. Each one of those dots is powered by a transistor.
Each picture element is switched on and off by a transistor in there. And right now, those are opaque transistors that they have to light shield, and so if you could have a larger aperture where you could get more light through, you'd have a better display.
So you could actually look through it like a window.
Just like a window, yeah. Another application that a lot of people seem to be able to relate, although it's a further out application, if you went to see Tom Cruise's movie last summer, Minority Report, or apparently there's a new one out, Matrix Reloaded. In both of those movies, they have a transparent transistor or a transparent display. And you, at first you say, well, who cares about a transparent display? But if you go see the Cruise movie in particular, the one I've seen, it really is pretty impressive. He's a futuristic cop. He's moving around these images, and he's teleconferencing with people all over the world. He's got all kinds of people around him, and he's able to display the images in a very, very crisp manner. Some of the military guys, when they've been seeing this, they got on the phone to a guy I know at the Air Force, and they're saying, we need transparent displays today. They're a long ways away, but if you can make transparent transistors, that's a first step towards that.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. So how far away are we, do you think?
I think that for the first cut applications like the active matrix liquid crystal select transistors, I think that's 2 to 4 years out. I'd have to say the transparent display is at least 5 and more likely 10 or even 15 years out. That'd be my guess.
Anything to add, gentlemen?
Well, I think that that's a very interesting issue and application of material science, but I think that one thing to keep in mind and try to understand about the nanoscale is that the types of transistors that Professor Wager is talking about would be effectively 1,000 times larger than what we're talking about.
Way bigger.
The transparent transistors are working at the scale of visible light, which is the micron scale. And the actual pixels that are used in displays are much larger than that. The types of electronics that Tom Tyson and I have been talking about at the nanometer scale, it's really a different universe. It's a factor of 1,000 smaller in one dimension, or a factor of 1,000,000 smaller when you consider the area of the devices. And so it's an entirely different set of physics, an entirely different set of challenges that are involved. In fact, they're both very hard. They're both very interesting and potentially extremely valuable. They have very different application spaces.
All right, let's see if we can get some phone calls. A lot of people want to talk. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Chris in Duluth. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Originally my question was about, just what is quantum computing, but in a more general sense, I'm a technology teacher at a local charter school, and I'd like to have some, means of discussion with my students about what the future of computing is, and from a hardware perspective. And so I think this panel would be a good one to ask that question.
Well, let me chime in. I would say that's quite a question to ask, and one that's couldn't be answered in the in any full way in the time of this that's allotted for this program. But basically, what we've seen is let me give you an analogy. Charles Babbage had the idea for the stored program computer, and he published that idea in about 18. I think the year was 1837, and now it's 100 and some years later. We're still trying to figure out the best way to make a stored program computer. And what Stan Williams and I, our research teams, are engaged in is trying to figure out what are the best components to make you know, to still make those stored program computers smaller, faster, cheaper, and so forth. Quantum computing is something that's so different from what we now call classical computing, the computing we've been used to, that first, I don't think we fully understand what it's going to be valuable for. But second, we don't have a clue, really, how to build a good, practical quantum computer at this time. And so what you see is thousands, literally thousands of scientists around the world studying different physical systems and trying to figure out which are the systems where I can prepare elements in a pure quantum state and then let them evolve in time under some controlling process or potentials that are applied, and then read them out in what we call a quantum limited measurement at the end. And every one of these steps in building one of these things and operating one of these things is at the absolute state of the art in terms of what can be done physically, even at the laboratory scale. So this is an extremely exciting adventure that we're embarked upon, but I don't know exactly where it's going at this point, other than because we take advantage of the degrees, the quantum degrees of freedom in nature rather than just the classical, we can see that at least certain types of computational problems can be done much more efficiently and much faster by quantum computers, provided we can figure out how to build them.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Could I just check, chime in just one quick thing here for Chris, and that is one thing he can tell his students is that we understand the laws of fundamental physics very well, and one thing that we can say is that our present-day computers are probably a factor of 1 billion away from being totally efficient as they could be given the laws of thermodynamics, relativity, and quantum mechanics. And so what that means is that his students have a tremendous opportunity to participate and to push the types of computing that we'll have in the future. I believe that we can continue to be improving our computing machinery for at least another 50 years, if not more than that.
You're saying they're wasting a lot of energy, power, things like that?
Oh, yeah.
A billion-fold.
A billion-fold improvement in performance in terms of the amount of computing you can do for the amount of electrical power that you put into it is theoretically possible. The challenge is how are we actually going to do it?
Mm-hmm. Let me just remind everybody that you're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking about quantum. We've gone all over the place and talking about nanotechnology, quantum physics. What about, you know, there are people who might say, you know, there's a new book out by Michael Crichton called Prey that talks about nanotechnology, and we mentioned a brief bit about the interface of actual molecules turning into nanocomputers. Is there not a fear among the public that something like this might get out of hand, and how do you deal with that?
Well, that's a real problem that we face right now, and a large part of the issue, frankly, is that the people who are raising these types of alarms are exactly the people who don't have any expertise in the field. I would say that in the past, when scientists have been working in areas that are have both risk and benefit associated with them, the scientists are usually the first to come out and start talking about the risks. And yes, there are risks with this technology. But no one that I know working in the field, including myself and many others who are actually working in the field, view the types of threats that you hear about in the gray goose scenarios as being credible. I think that also with respect to the National Nanotechnology Initiative in the United States, which is the large initiative which is trying to make nanotechnology real, What we've done in those of us who've helped to craft this is we have put a sociological piece of the system in the initiative. In other words, we are looking for feedback from the public. We're trying to both understand what the public's interests and concerns are with the technology and trying to respond to them. And this is really because of the problems that that biotech had. There were a lot of uncertainty and ignorance about biotech and what it could do and what it might get out of hand. And I think because scientists in general did not pay attention to the public A lot of those concerns really got out of hand, and you see some of the situations in Europe and others where they are so concerned about what they call Frankenfoods. Mm-hmm. So with respect to nanotechnology, I think that we've tried to be, the scientists working in the area, I believe, have tried to be more responsive and more responsible in terms of answering people's questions about this area. And one thing that people in general who are interested in nanotechnology is, I would recommend one single website, and that's www.nano.gov, G-O-V. That's the web page of the U.S. Nanotechnology Initiative, and it's the only web page out there that has information on it that I feel is essentially certified and trustable. Just about anything else that you would tap into just at random by typing nano into a search engine is likely to give you garbage.
I think also scientists and engineers and industry in general is not just responsive, but it's anticipatory. We're doing some very early stage material development, and immediately we look at the materials and say, is this a toxic material? Is this a potentially a hazardous material? And in trying to do the materials engineering from the first cut, we try to avoid those sort of materials.
Dr. Wager, any comment?
That was my comment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was me.
I'm sorry.
Wrong voice.
Tom Tice.
No, I think Stan had it right. If you look at what scientists are actually doing in their laboratories, it has absolutely nothing to do with any of the self-replicating scenarios or gray goo scenarios. The example that I gave you of how you grow a snowflake, that's what self-assembly is about, and people do sometimes confuse self-assembly with self-replication, which is very different in level of complexity, and is simply something that scientists can't even contemplate at this working on at this time.
All right. Well, I got to interrupt again. We've got to take a break. We also have to say goodbye to Dr. Wager. He's got to go back to classes. John Wager is a professor in the School of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you. We'll continue with Stan Williams and Thomas Tice and your questions, so stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan Monday in this hour for a Memorial Day look at war memories. Plus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News next Monday in this hour. We're talking today about the future of microelectronics and how to bring those laboratory innovations to market with my guest Stan Williams, Director of Quantum Science Research for Hewlett-Packard Labs, Thomas Tice, Director of Physics Science Research at IBM's T.J. Watson Research Center, our number 1-800-989-8255. Gentlemen, many years ago, we were talking about budgets, talking about when the giant accelerator that was supposed to be built in Texas was killed, costing billions of dollars. And I used to get calls from materials scientists who'd say, you know, if I just had one-tenth of the money that went into these giant physics projects, the things we could come up with. Still true? Is there a bill? Do you think there's more federal money? Is there a bill in Congress now to help out on nanotechnology, Tom?
Well, go
ahead, Stan.
Okay, yes, there is. Just recently, in both the House and Senate, there have been versions of a bill to take what's been called the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which was a focused effort to try to bring more funding directly into nanotechnology, for instance, and turn it into a longer-range program, give it a little bit more coordination among various government agencies, and maybe lock it in for a little bit longer term. So the total budget, the three-year budget for this National Nanotechnology Initiative is actually something like $2.4 billion. Now, that probably sounds like a lot, but in fact, it's interesting that the Japanese, what they do is they look at what the U.S. Congress passes, and they sort of have a set goal that every time the U.S. government passes a budget for nanotechnology, the Japanese are going to raise it by 10%. And when you think that the Japanese economy is half ours, they have completely committed themselves to always invest 10% more in nanotechnology research than the United States. The Europeans are boasting that they're investing twice as much as we are in nanotechnology, and then other countries like Korea, Taiwan, Singapore are putting huge fractions of their actually not only R&D budgets, but if you think about it, their entire GNPs into nanotechnology research, because they believe that this is the future for their economies. And then finally, you look at China. China's National Nanotechnology Initiative is the equivalent of $200 million a year. But when you think about what a dollar buys in China, in fact, you know, in some ways, they probably have the world's largest nanotechnology initiative, and certainly the largest number of students being trained in this area. So it's an area where you do get a lot of bang for the buck, actually, but there's a lot of work to do, and there's really a ferocious international competition in the area right now.
1-800-989-8255. Sean in San Antonio, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I was wondering what the implications were for AI.
Artificial intelligence?
Yeah.
Okay, let's ask that question. Well, as you shrink down these devices and you can put hundreds of millions or billions of them, do we get any closer to AI or recreating the human brain or anything like that?
The implication is only that as we shrink things down, we can build systems of greater and greater complexity, at which point you would decide that the system was complex enough that you would be impressed by its intelligence is one that I think will be subjective and up to the observer. You know, it would have been pretty amazing to in the 1960s to say that computers would routinely beat humans at games like chess, and of course they do that and many other things now, but we're used to that and we're not so impressed by it, and we wonder why computers are so stupid at lots of other things that we do very well. But certainly there's lots of things like being able to recognize complex patterns, which would have very important applications in business, and people are working on that. That's a job for computer scientists, and we who work on the hardware components to make all that capability less expensive every year, will contribute to the growth of those kinds of applications.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the 1950s, the growth of the transistor and integrated circuits was really a lot of it was fueled by the Defense Department wanting to create tiny little devices to put up in space in the military. Is that Is that still true now with this business?
Well, absolutely. It turns out that the integrated circuit itself was invented in response to a challenge by the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is an arm of the Department of Defense.
Same people that created the Internet.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So what they did was they essentially put out a challenge to the community to say, all right, we've got these wonderful little transistors, but right now they're kind of useless because we can't figure out how to glue them together. And with that sort of challenge thrown at the feet of the community, the integrated circuit was effectively invented, twice in two different places at roughly the same time, at Texas Instruments and by Bob Noyce, who was at Fairchild Electronics, I guess they called it. So today you find very similar things. DARPA is challenging us again. They've recently put out a challenge to be able to build a processor which would be roughly have the capability of the first Intel microprocessor, the 4004, that was actually built in 1971. But what DARPA is saying they want is they want this thing to be effectively a million times smaller and be able to run on a tiny fraction of the power. So, so that's a challenge that they put out there to see if it can be met by people. But it turns out that the DoD budgets are not as overwhelming as they used to be. It used to be that DoD could just sort of by nudging a little bit of their funding here and there, get everyone to fall in line and do what they said wanted to be done. But right now, for instance, the games market is much larger than the DoD market. So it's an interesting mix now. The DoD can influence, but they can't direct.
So the Nintendos, the Segas, the things, the Sonys, the things like that, that's driving these shrinkage of these things.
Whatever the volume market is, Ira, that whatever requires the most chips, and game machines certainly sell millions and millions of chips, so that tends to drive the investment.
I always said we should have patented that first computer game that was, you know, it was made by a military out on Long Island. Did you know that? The Pong game was created out in Upton, Long Island at Brookhaven. never patented. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Tom, where do we go from here? What tools? What tools does your industry need to move forward to the next step?
Oh, my. That's another question that can't be answered in a short time. We're always working on new tools. IBM does have IBM Research does have a history of inventing some of the key instruments for seeing and manipulating atoms, the atomic force microscope, the scanning tunneling microscope, were invented in the 80s, and you can find those in every semiconductor fab, every hard disk drive factory in the world would have those kinds of scanning probe instruments so that people could see what's going on in the things that they're building at the nanoscale. We continue to develop those kind of instruments. I guess we just got some recent publicity because we worked with a small company called Neon on electron optics, and we're able to build the world's highest resolution electron microscope, and we're able to actually watch single gold atoms dance on a surface with that microscope in real time. So I think the industry does need more of that kind of development. But we're also at the stage where we need to develop the manufacturing processes, and that's a lot of what Stan and I were talking about when we talk about self-assembly. We need to develop sets of processes that will enable us to make these extremely complex systems and build them up out of these nanoscale components.
Talking about building the next generation of transistors and electronics devices this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we can get in a phone call or two before we have to say goodbye. Let's go to Wallace. Hi, Wallace. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there.
I just wanted to ask about a holographic technology. When you were talking about the transparent transistors, I was under the impression, like you were referring to The Matrix and the other movie with Tom Cruise, I was under the impression that that was with holographic technology. And also, I wanted to know about the holographic hard drives in the nanocomputers. I guess what's going on
that? Well, of course, the movie was all imaginary technology anyway. It was all special effects. So and I didn't see the movie, so I can't really respond to whether it was a holographic projection or not. Holographic projections are really almost a totally different type of technology for displays that might involve transparent transistors, but likely might not either. But it's really an entirely different realm than we've been discussing so far. In terms of storage devices, there's been a lot of good ideas trying to use holography to as storage media, but in fact, I tend to be of the opinion that effectively atoms and molecules are the best types of storage media, and we recently demonstrated a very high density electronic storage medium in which molecules were the actual elements that were storing data. And it was just a simple laboratory demonstration, but it had a density of 30 times current DRAM, and we think we can scale it by another factor of 1,000. So I think that putting electrons or having molecules that you can address electronically in the long run will be much higher storage density than holography will be.
I would agree with that. That's one of the problems with doing anything with light is that light wavelengths are actually rather large compared to the dimensions we're talking about when we talk about devices that manipulate electrons.
Mm-hmm. So photons, then, the particles of light.
Photons are really great for communications. They haven't been very effective for computing so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can think of photons as great big fat blobby Nerf balls, and they're just really big in a way. They're really kind of hard to handle. They're wonderful for communicating information, as Tom said. And my own mantra is that as we go forward into the century, computation is going to be electronic and communication is going to be photonic.
I'd have to agree with that. That's the way it looks.
So eventually, we're going to hit the limit of where we can store this with the known devices and the research devices that we have. Do we know where that wall is going to come? How many years from now? Do you think you can always find something new that will push the envelope?
We can for quite a long time. As Stan alluded to their research, that they hope they can take things another factor of 1,000 beyond what's been demonstrated in terms of the density of storing information, and that still wouldn't quite reach the atomic limit. And beyond that, we could think of quite a few tricks to continue to make things smaller, faster, and cheaper.
Stan, you agree?
Yes, I do. I've just tried to look at the pace of progress over the past 40 years, which has been sort of, given the name of Moore's Law. And my firm belief is that we can continue to improve our electronics into the future at the rate that we have in the past for at least another 50 years before we run into anything that's a fundamental limit, before we have to really, before we have to worry about violating any particular laws of physics.
Well, we'll hang around and see if we can talk to you in 50 years from now.
Well, I hope I'll be here then.
All right, we have a date, okay? Thank you both for joining us this hour. Stan Williams, Director of Quantum Science Research for the Hewlett-Packard Labs in Palo Alto, California, and Thomas Tice, Director of Physical Science Research at IBM's T.J. Watson Research Center in Yorktown Heights, New York. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
You're welcome.
Yes, thank you very much.
Earlier, we spoke with John Wager, professor in the School of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Our program is produced today by Annette Heist, Charles Berquist, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Our intern is Adrian McDonald. And if you'd like to feedback to us, you can write to us at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. Or if you missed any of the stuff we talked about today, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We also have Science Friday's Kids Connection there, which we make educational materials free for students and teachers to take with them. And you can download also past editions of Science Friday on your Audible player. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.